one of the topics that becomes very relevant to Purim is Amalek, whether it's Zechiras Amalek, whether it's Mechias Amalek. It could be that reading the Megillah itself is a kiyum of Zechiras Amalek. So I have here an essay about the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek. And I don't expect that in the next 15 minutes until we start the shiur officially we'll be able to go through this. It's hours and hours of work. But at least to get a start, get a taste of it. At the end of Parshas B'Shalach, there's a mechilta that says the following. Rabbi Lazar HaModoi, which is right next to my house over here, Omer, Nishba HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Kisei HaKovod Shelo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is holding on to the Holy Throne, and he takes an oath. He says, Im Aniach Nin V'Neched Shel HaMolek Tachas Kol HaShamayim. There won't be anything left of Amalek. All his descendants will be destroyed. Shelo Yomru, they won't even be able to say, Gamal Zeh, this camel belongs to Amalek. So we see one thing that's interesting from this Mechilta is that the concept of Mechias Amalek includes not just Zera Shel Amalek, his descendants, but it also includes his animals. And that's included in the mitzvah of Mechias Zecher Amalek. In fact, Rashi in Parshas Ki Teitze on the Pasuk Timcha Es Zecher Amalek, Rashi writes, Shelo Yeh Shem Amalek Nizkar Afilu Al HaBehem Alomar Behem Azu Mishal Amalek Hoysa. So all this is fine. We have the Mechilta at the end of B'Shalach, we have Rashi at the end of Parshas Ki Teitze, and the mitzvah Mechias Amalek includes anything that might remind us of Amalek, including his animals. But now let's take the Torah and fast forward to Shmuel. Shmuel gives, in the name of God, the command to Sholomel to kill Amalek. And it says there, Vehemato me ish ad isha, me oleil viad yonek, mi shor viad se, mi gamal viad chamor. Okay, so far so good. The command includes animals as well. Destroy the animals of Amalek. But Rashi says the following. Sheyu balek shofim, shahayu balek shofim, umeshanin atzmo vidomim lebehema. In other words, this description of a seh and a gamal and a chamor, a shor, etc., all this is really the destruction of Amalek. Just that they appear in the guise of an animal. That's called the kishuv. And a lot of kishuv is about human beings that appear or show up in the form of an animal. But it seems from Rashi that there's no mitzvah of destroying the behemoth Amalek in and of itself, only because we might be afraid that this is an Amaleki, this animal is really an Amaleki. That doesn't seem to be what Rashi holds in Parshas Ki Teitze, where he says that any Zecher Amalek has to be destroyed. Even a behemoth, they'll say this behemoth once belonged to an Amaleki. So what is it? Are we destroying the behemoths of Amalek because of the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek? Or are we destroying the behemoths of Amalek because they are Amalek? So he introduces here the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos, who writes that Mitzvos Mechias Amalek Eino Noheges Ad Yemos HaMashiach, that we don't have in our time the ability to fight the battle to destroy Amalek. We have to wait for Mashiach. Shenemar, the Smag quotes a pasuk, V'hoya baniach Hashem Elokecha lecha mikol oivech misaviv, at the end of Parshas Ki Teitze, Timcha Zecher Amalek. So it sounds like the Timcha Zecher Amalek, that mitzvah, is only active after we destroy all our enemies. So first we make sure that all the enemies that surround Eretz Yisrael are destroyed, and then, and only then, do we destroy Amalek. And this, according to the Smag, is foretelling the future at the time of Mashiach. The Radaz actually refers to this Smag in Hilchus Melachim Perakei, he writes, Ra'isi Misha Kosam She'ein Mitzvah Zuno Heges Ad Yivos HaMashiach. U'parsha Shmuel V'Shaul Havituvta. What are we going to do with the parsha of Shmuel? After all, Shmuel gives a command to Shaul to destroy Amalek. That's not Mashiach. And then we have another question. Why is it that Shaul has to receive a special mandate from Shmuel based on a nevuah that Shmuel received? What about the mitzvah of Milchemes Amalek? Shaul should have, on his own initiative, without waiting for Shmuel and the nevuah, should have begun the process of Milchemes Amalek. According to the Smag, it makes sense, because the Smag says that this mitzvah depends upon Moshiach. So therefore, Shaul had to receive a special command to destroy Amalek. But the Radbaz, as we saw, is not so happy with the Smag, because he thinks that what Shaul was doing and the command that he got from Shmuel was to go out and to battle against Amalek and fulfill the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek. And we don't have to wait till Mashiach. But then according to the Radbaz, we don't understand why Shaul HaMelech had to wait for a command from Shmuel. So just before we go on, we'll have a few more minutes to finish the paragraph. I want to point out something that I heard, not directly, but in the name of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. You familiar with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik?
Yes.
So Rav Aaron used to say that the mitzvah Mechias HaMolek depends upon the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMolek, and the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMolek depends upon Pakod Efkod, which means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu remembers HaMolek and we have to remember HaMolek. And the point that Rav Aaron was trying to convey was that the mitzvah Mechias HaMolek is conditional. It's not applicable at every moment throughout Jewish history. There are certain moments in Jewish history when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I remember Amalek, and therefore I want you to go out and destroy Amalek. And if you look in the parasha in Shmuel, the introduction to that whole parasha is Pakod Efkod. I don't have the Nach in front of me, but in any event it says there that I've remembered Amalek. Now, who can tell me, if let's say I'm a king of Israel, who can tell me and notify me that Hashem has remembered Amalek and he wants me now to destroy Amalek? The answer is a novel. So the whole enterprise of Mechias Amalek, says Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, is contingent upon a Navi. So that even though the mitzvah of Amalek would apply... Oh, wow, you have a mitzvah parasha. Here. Omar Hashem Tzvokos pakadati es asher asa Amalek li Yisrael asher som lo baderech balosu mitzrayma. So this is the introduction to the mitzvah v'ato lech v'kisas Amalek. There's a precondition here that has to be met. And that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu declares, I remember Amalek. Rav Aaron has a whole discussion about the word pakadati. It doesn't say zacharti, but rather it says pakadati. And he claims that the word pakadati means that what I see now reminds me of what was earlier, meaning that the early seeds of Amalek that was sown way back when Klal Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim, and the evil that Amalek perpetuated is continuing even today. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I see now, today, that Amalek is still the old Amalek. Nothing has changed. They're still totally dedicated to destroy the Jewish people. And that's called pakadati. I remember what they did then, and I see that today they're following in the same behavior pattern. And therefore go and destroy Amalek. So again, if the Radbaz is right, against the Smag, that the mitzvah of Amalek is not dependent upon Mashiach, so why is it that Shaul has to wait for a nevuah from Shmuel? And the answer is because of this concept of pakadati, and that's the precondition for the mitzvah of Amalek. That can only come through a Navi. The other option to say is that why does Shaul need a Navi? That's because, according to the Smag, there is no mitzvah of Mechias Amalek in our time. We have to wait till Mashiach. And that's derived from the pasuk of Hayu Maniach However, although we have to wait for Mashiach, if at a certain point in time Hashem commands us to destroy Amalek, then there is a mitzvah to destroy Amalek, obviously, and that comes through the medium of a Navi. Now, the Rambam's introduction to Pirush HaMishnayos and Seder Zrayim, he speaks about a Navi, and he says, V'yetzavet tzivuyim v'yesar isurim b'davar she'eino min ha-Torah. In other words, in cases where the Torah doesn't tell you one way or the other whether you're obligated to implement a certain mitzvah, here's where the Navi could reveal that you're obligated at this moment in time to fulfill a mitzvah. Kagon. And the Rambam gives the following example. Sheyomar, that the Navi reveals, Hilachmu al ir plonis, go out to battle against this city. Oh, im uma plonis, or go out and destroy a certain nation. Kimbo, says the Rambam, Shetziva Shmuel Shaul li lochem im Amalek. So it sounds like the Rambam is telling us that on the one hand, there is a mitzvah to destroy Amalek, but on the other hand, we need a Navi to tell us, it's a little bit similar to what we were saying before, that B'dover She'enu min HaTorah, meaning How do we interpret this Rambam? V'dover she'enu min haTorah. He says the Sfir Leil Aram Kasmag the mitzvah lo noheges ad yimos haMashiach v'lo hayas shol mitzuva lilachim amolek mitzad mitzvah samachil samach rak Shmuel tzivalo b'nevua b'horah shah she'ilachim imahem. So it's not exactly what we said before in the name of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, that the mitzvah applies, but just the precondition that we have to know something about Hashem's pakadati, and that's where the Navi reveals that to us. No, he's saying it's midin horasha, that although the mitzvah of Mechias HaMolek does not apply until Mashiach, that's the smag, but nevertheless there's something called a horasha. So that means that although a Navi does not have the authority to command me in a mitzvah, he doesn't even have the authority to decide and opine about when a mitzvah should apply and not apply. That's called lo bashamayimi. But he does have the power to give me a command, harasha, meaning for this particular juncture in history. Ulefize yeshlomer the svile l'rashi kasmag v'aram. This man Shmuel v'shal lo naga mitzvahs mechias hamolek v'lacham shal im amolek mitzad mitzvahs mechias hamolek. Ki im hayetzivui miyuchad, what we call the horas shah, b'nevuah she'ilachmu imahim, l'fiz ha'nireh, the svir l'rashi, the afagav to be ikar, mitzvah shel mechias ha'molek, the alfinon mi, timcha zecher ha'molek, af behemus b'chlal ha'mitzvah, mikol makom, b'hach mitzvah miyuchedis l'sha'ul, l'ilachim im ha'molek, lo hayu ha'behemus b'chlal ha'mitzvah. Say no chinami, in the general universal mitzvah of ha'molek, of mechias ha'molek, whenever it applies, as we saw in the Mechilta at the end of Mishalach in the name of Rabbi Lazar Modoi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, destroy even the animals of Amalek. But what we see in the parasha of Shaul, and Rashi says that Shaul would only destroy the behemoths because they were Amalekim in a different guise, that has nothing to do with the general mitzvah as it's defined conceptually of Mechias Amalek, because we're holding now, Rashi's holding like the smag, and there is no mitzvah Mechias Amalek. We have to wait for Mashiach. But what we have here in the case of Shaul is Horas Shah. So now this Horas Shah is a special command with its own unique conditions. And Rashi says that the condition was that only Amalekim should be destroyed and not the behemoths. And the only reason Shaul is going to destroy the behemoths is because of the shinui, that the Amalekim appear as animals. Good morning. I'm just finishing up a little bit of a discussion here about Mechias HaMolek. So we'll start in about 2 minutes, if that's okay. V'nafkimina bazeh, d'ba mechilta d'rashbi, garsina shlo yomru gamal zeh shal HaMolek, rachel zu shal HaMolek, ilan zeh shal HaMolek. V'tzalomer, shlo yeshem HaMolek nizkar, afilo al rechusham, ki ilanos ubehemos, Ubatehem, let's destroy anything that has any association with Amalek, so nobody will remember the name of Amalek. They won't point to this and say, oh, this belonged to an Amalek. Aval b'maisa de Shaul de loksiv timcha es zecher amolik. Not talking about the mitzvah mechias amolik because that we'll have to wait until asher heinichach Hashem olkech mikol ivecha misaviv. Dakayetzivu miyuchad. But he had a special command, the horash shav through the medium of the navi of Shmuel. Lahachmin behemtam. So again, with the case of Shaul is not a case of Mechias Amolek classic, but rather it's a special mitzvah and it has its own rules and regulations. Okay then? So we'll make a siyum on this, although again this is a long discussion. And now we go back to Daf Ches Amud Beis. That's where we're holding. And we're starting the Gemara. We started it yesterday. Let's go over it again. The Mishnah had established that a muskar, a mitzorah muskar, which means that we saw a nega ba'or b'soro in one of the various categories of the Goyim, but we haven't yet seen any simoni tara. We have the tseva, we have the color, we have the size, we have a kagris. And at that point, the Kohen decides on Hezger. Again, we had many different opinions what exactly Hezger is. And his din is identical to a din of a Mitzorah Mukhlat. Except for one Yotze Min HaKlal. Where is there a hair's breadth, so to speak, of difference between a Mitzorah Muzgar and a Mitzorah Mukhlat? The Mishnah establishes that's with regard to Tiglachas Vitziporim, which means that a mitzorah, as part of his long and complicated process of purification, he has to shave all the hair off his body, and there's a whole ritual with two birds. Those two dimensions of taras hamitzorah only apply to a mitzorah mukhlat, but not to a muzgar. And the Gemara is going to spend a lot of time trying to figure this all out. How do we know that Tiglachas and Tziporim applies exclusively to a Mukhlat and not to a Muzgar? Now, before we start the Gemara, I want to mention a Rashi later on. Rashi later on says that there is an additional difference between a Muzgar and a Mukhlat that might be implicit in the Mishnah, but it's not explicit in the Mishnah. And that has to do with the Karbonos. And Rashi says that the Karbonos of a Mitzorah, which are brought on the eighth day of his Tara process, is those Karbonos are only obligatory for a Mitzorah Mukhlat. And the Kesef Mishnah derives the same conclusion from the Rambam. The language of the Rambam in Tumas Tzoras is Ein Bein Mitzora Muska Le Mitzora Mukhlat Le Inyan Tuma Ela Priya Uprima Vitiglachas Vitziporim. And why did the Rambam have to add Le Inyan Tuma Ein Bein Mitzora Muska Le Mitzora Mukhlat Le Inyan Tuma? Because Le Inyan Karbonos Yet Od Chiluk Veinehem. There are other distinctions between these two categories of Mitzorah with regard to Karbonos. Okay, so just keep that in mind, that although the Mishnah explicitly identifies these two dimensions of Taras HaMitzorah as the distinction between this and that, namely Tiglachas and Tziporim, it seems from both Rashi and the Rambam that there's a broader distinction with regard to the Karbonos that a Mitzorah has to bring. And hopefully we'll get to discuss that later on.
What's the havamina that a muska should bring a korban?
In fact, we're going to have two approaches in general to muska. I'll mention as an introduction. I was hoping to get to it inside. One approach is that a muska is guilty until proven innocent, meaning that the muska, since the Torah includes him in the parish of Tuma, he should be included in the parish of Tara as well. Whatever we need for Tahara is going to apply to a muska unless proven innocent. There's going to be a whole other approach, and that is that we have to prove in a positive way that a muskar has all the dinim of a mukhlat, and until we establish that, we don't really know. So that's going to be the sugya. So as far as karbonos of a mitzorah is concerned, we'd have to go through the parasha inside and see if we need a proof that the karbonos apply even to a muskar, or that's the simple pshat in the pesukim. So the Gemara now is medayik, as we always are at the Ein Beins, that if the distinction in the formulation of the Mishnah is limited to Tiglachas and Tziporim, hola inyan shiluach vetuma zeveze shovim. Okay, now as far as shiluach is concerned, which is a sugya unto itself, and the word shiluach usually means to be sent chutz lamachne. So chutz lamachne doesn't apply to every single city and village in Israel. So let's say you find the Kohen declares a certain individual as a mitzorah muchlat, that we have to get rid of him from that city. But it only applies to a city that's sanctified. In other words, the tumas tzaras is antithetical. It's a contamination on a, we'll call it a halachic contamination, that's antithetical to a kedusha of the city. And what kind of city has kedusha? So this is called an ir mukefes choma, a walled city. Again, this, you know, everything here is a sugya. You know, so you know, whenever I say to you it's a sugya, what I mean to say is don't ask me too many questions, because we'd have to learn a whole other sugya. Basically, this is Masechta Erchin, and it's the end of Sefer Vayikra, the walled cities. We touched on it, if you remember, at the beginning of Masechta Megillah, when we spoke about Megillah on the 15th of Adar for the Korachim. And there's something called Ir Mukefes Choma, and that has an impact on the law of Geulas HaSodah. You remember that the Torah gives you a right to, after you sold your field, to redeem it. And that depends upon whether the city's a walled city or not. So, but just suffice it to say for our purposes that a walled city has a certain kedusha to it. You know, if you're a Zionist lecturer and you want to find a source for the IDF in Halacha, you know, the significance of the Israeli Defense Forces, it would probably be in this parasha of a city that's walled, meaning the Torah attributes kedusha and sanctity to a city that's secure. Secure in the literal sense. So if the Chayalim are guaranteeing our security, that gives them a certain level of kedusha. That was just a side comment. Okay, now, what happens to a mitzorah muskar? We had various interpretations of what muskar meant, but none of those interpretations mean that we have to quarantine him and expel him from the city. So even though it's an ir mukefes choma, a muskar is not on the same level of tumah as a muchlat. He's sort of in abeyance, you know, his status is sort of in suspended animation. And therefore, at this point, there's no din of shiluach. How about as far as tumah is concerned? Oh. So what we're looking for now is the unique aspect of tumah that the Torah was machadesh with regard to a mitzorah, a very unique kind of tumah. It has perhaps a parallel in the most severe of all tumas, on the top of the totem pole, which is called tumas mes. Now, what is unique about tumas mes, and now it applies also, we're applying it also to mitzorah, if he's a mukhlat, that's called tumas ohel. So if a human being finds himself in the same house, under the same roof, as a mes, as a corpse, then he contracts tumah. And that is the most severe tumah, which is called avi avos hatumah, that it's metame even adam v'kelim. Right, there are different levels of tumah. And the highest level of tumah is going to be this tumah of ohel hames. A similar halacha of tumah applies, when I say similar there is a difference, in the case of mitzorah. Now what does that mean? If a person finds himself in the same ohel as a mitzorah, and we'll soon see that's only a mukhlat, then just like in the case of a mess, where he finds himself in the same hole as a mess, that's called nichnas lebeis hamenuga. In the case of nigei batim, I'll get back to that in a split second. O lebay sheyesha mitzora. So then, he and his kelim become tome. They contract tumah. This is very unique to the parsha of Nagoyim. Now there are two, there are really three parshas of Nagoyim. I'm going to focus for a minute on two of them. There's nigei basar, which is nigei aguf, and then there's nigei batim. Correct? And in the parsha of nigei batim, the kohen determines that the bias has a nega, and if somebody enters into that bias, then he becomes tome. And there's an equation between nigei batim and nigei aguf. Just like in nigei batim, if the bias is tomei benegoyim, then anyone who enters into it, he and his kelim become a contract tumah. So too, in the case of nigei aguf, if somebody enters into a house where there's a mitzorah, he and his kelim contract tumah. But this level of tumah is a little bit different. It's one notch lower than tumas mes, than oil and tumas mes. Why? Because in ol and tumas mes, if the mes and the person or his kelim are in the same ohel for one split second, they contract tumah, a fraction of a second. Mashiach came in the case of beis hamenuga or nigei guf. There's a shear. There's a certain minimum shear of time that the person has to be in the ohel of the mitzorah before he contracts tumah, and that's called a shear of kidei achilas pras. Now, exactly how long that is, I don't know. It's not a very long time. Maximum might be 9 minutes. Some say it's as little as 2 minutes. And then there's every shita between 2 and 9. But be that as it may, it's a shear of achilas pras. So in other words, if I walk into a house and there's a mitzorah, then I immediately turn my back and run out. I say, oh, I got to get out of here. There's a mitzorah here. Then I can save myself from tumah. But if I walk into a, you know, like in a hospital, you know, you have special provisions for the kohen. But if, let's say, a kohen walks into a hospital and there's a dead corpse in the hospital, then even if he runs out immediately, it wouldn't change anything. Because that's the severity, the highest level of tumas oel, which is tumas hames. So now we distinguish between muchlat and muzgar. Correct? And the Mishnah says that the difference between the two is only with regard to Tiglachas and Tziporim, implying that in other dimensions of Tumah, there should be an equation between Muzgar and Mukhlat. So a few minutes ago, I asked you what happens if a Mitzorah Muzgar is sitting in the city. Is there a din of shiluach? And for the same token, I could ask you, what happens if I walk into an ohel and there's a mitzorah muzgar in the ohel? So the Gemara says, zevez eshoven. Apparently, if we have an equation between muchlat and muzgar, as far as tumah is concerned, because the only difference is going to be in the tara process of tiglathas and tziporim, and we have an equation between muzgar and muchlat, straight across the board, that should include both shiluach and tumah. So it means that the severity of the status of a muzgar, insofar as it equals the severity of the status of a muchlat, generates all the dinim that apply to tumah. Number one, the special category of tumah of ohel. Number two, the special requirement of shiluach min ha-machne, which means machne yisrael is an ear shemukefes choma. That's going to be zevezes shovin. So what we're left with is the following distinction. We have ein bein mitzorah muzkar le mitzorah muchlat ela priya uprima. So we had that distinction with regard to priya and prima. So the Gemara now wants to explain, what is the source? How do you know that priya and prima, right? We said that the hair has to go wild and the garments have to be rendered. How do you know that that applies exclusively to a mukhlat and not to a muzgar? And here we have a basic machlokas, how to interpret the Gemara. When the Gemara asks, mi nahani mili, what is the Gemara looking for? Is the Gemara looking for a proof that priya and prima does not apply to a mitzora muskar? Or is the Gemara trying to prove that if the Torah says there's no priya and prima by a muskar, then it means as far as all other dinim are concerned, they're equal? Do you follow me? So let's go with Rashi's pshat first. Rashi's going to assume that we have an equation between muskar and mukhlat, and therefore minani mili, the Gemara is asking, how do you know that the exception to that equation is going to be prima and priya? In other words, how do we know that priya and prima is limited to a mukhlat? It does not apply to a muskar. The Tani Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzchak. And if you can, please underline Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak, because the name is very important as it comes up throughout the sugya. Kami de Rav Huna. In other words, Rav Shmuel came up with a brisa, which he presented to Rav Huna. And the brisa says the following. The Torah says, with regard to a mitzora, if he was a muskar and then he became tar, it says v'tiaro hakoin mispachasi. Mispachas means that it doesn't have simoni tuma, and therefore mispachas is like, remember we spoke about bohak. In other words, we send him home. It's not a nega, that's metame. And then watch this, v'chibes begodov v'taher. Now it's interesting. The word vitaher, the way it's conjugated, is in what's called Lashon Asid, in the future tense. No, I'm sorry. Scratch that. If it was in the future tense, it should have said vitaher. Instead it says vitaher, and that's in the past tense. And he is tahar, meaning he is already tahar. In the language of the Brisa, it means tahar Meikara. He already was tar. Now wait a second. He's about, after the Kohen declares him tar, he's about to go into the mikvah and be mitar himself. So how could it be that the Torah used the word vitaher? He is already tar. The Torah should have used the language viyitar in the future, that he will become tar when he finishes the process of purification, namely when he's tovel himself in the mikvah. So obviously, there's one element at least of tuma, which does not apply in this case. And as we said before, this parasha is the parasha of a muzgar. And what is the element that doesn't apply? Says the Braisa, tahar. He was already tahar even before he went to the mikvah. Mi priya uprima. Demeikar. In other words, even before he undergoes the process of tvila, to be matar mitzaroso, he was exempt from priya and prima. Now, that dimension of nihuge tuma does not apply to a muzgar. And how do I know this? Because it says vitaher, and it means he was already tahor. Now the Shagas Aryeh in Turi Evan is bothered. Okay, let's say you prove from the word vitaher that he's already tahor, but how do you know from what dimension of tuma the Torah is exempting him? You know, there are any number of possible scenarios or possible understandings. Why did the Gemara focus? Why did the Braisa single out priya and prima? And here the Shagas Aryeh applies a methodological rule that I think is universal in drashos, and the rule is that whenever you have an exclusion, then you assume the minimum, the least chidush. Does that make sense to you, what I just said? Should I say one more time, just to make sure we have it? In other words, if the Torah is saying an exclusion, right? According to Rashi, the Torah is saying that he's already tar from X. So then, if you have a list of candidates, of possibilities for what that X is, choose the one that's most, that's least mechudush, that's least radical, if you follow what I mean. That's
the simplest.
The simplest in a certain sense.
But why is...
Oh, so why is prima and prima the simplest? Oh, so here's where the Talmud Shagasari has a big chiddush. Why is it that of all the Nihugei Tumah that apply to a Mitzorah, this one, called Priya and Prima, is down on the bottom of the list? And he says the following. That the requirement of Priya and Prima applies only to males and not to females. In other words, the parasha of Mitzorah, with all its trimmings and all its... shall I say it's tumah, applies equally to both a man and a woman. But there is one difference between a man and a woman, and that is priya and prima. That priya and prima do not apply to nashim, they only apply to anashim.
So
I'll read to you the language here.
It's already a limited exclusion. Already a limited application anyway.
Right. And that makes it like low on the totem pole. And as you already see, that we punch certain holes in the pre and prima requirement. Now, for some reason, I'm not finding it right now. But anyway, I remember that from the Turiyev. I'm just reading again. Anyway. Oh, here it is. He says the following. Priya and Prima hu akal biyoser midine tuma. And he says, why? Shari b'chol dini mitzora shavim ha'ish v'ha'isha milvad din priya u'prima she'eno b'noshim. That women are excluded in the parasha of Tzoras from Priya and Prima. That makes it the kal biyoser, the kal with the kuf. That's his language.
A pasuk for that? Because
he doesn't quote a pasuk here, so I don't have access to the Turi Evan, although I do own a Turi Evan at home, but I don't have one here with me. Remind me to tell you a story about my copy of the Turi Evan. I have a first edition of the Turi Evan. Anyway, so now the Turi Evan also has another chidush here in this sugya, and here he disagrees with Rashi. If you remember, Rashi's pshat, which we presented here in the sugya, was that we're looking for a proof that priya and prima doesn't apply to a muzgar. The Turi Evan says the exact opposite. The Gemara's Minah and Imili is asking Minayan, how do we know that mitzora muzgar shava b'din tumah la mitzora buchlat? How do we know buchlalat is a din of tumah? And the Gemara says that since we have a mute for Tayer to exclude prima and priya, is ipso facto, I derive the conclusion that otherwise there is an equation in tumah. So again, that was my guilty until proven innocent question number four. Okay. Now, in order to understand Rava's objection to this whole drush of Rav Shmuel, let me give the following two introductions. The previous mission that we discussed was about Zav. And if you remember, we spoke about Zav, that he has a status of avatuma, and there was a very distinctive chumrah in Zav that's called Heset. Okay, let's talk for a minute about Tumas Heset. Now, there's classical Tumas Heset and there's the unique Tumas Heset of a Zav. In classical Tumas Heset, what happens is that the man who is tahar is mesit es hatuma. In other words, he causes a dover tame to move. However, and this is even without negiah, because again, there's another tuma called tumas maga. So again, if he touched the sherets or whatever it is, that's not tumas maga. That's tumas maga. That's not tumas hese. The chiddush of tumas hese is if he causes it to move. You remember that? I think I once spoke about this. Yeah. I'll give the mashal again. I don't know if Eric, you were there when I discussed. It's called kinetic energy, I think, in fancy English, right? If let's say I have these three coins, right? So if I move this coin, I can cause this coin to move without even touching it. That's kinetic energy, right? So what happens is, if this is stationary, when this hits up against this, this moves. So there was no maga between A and C. There was only between A and B. But the movement of A against B causes the movement of C, even though B remains static. That's called kinetic energy. Again, don't ask me anything about physics because I didn't even take basic physics.
That's okay. I'm comfortable with physics. Yeah. But if C doesn't move,
right,
because you can't have it it's where something
then that's not Hesse.
Then it wouldn't, okay.
Right. Hesse is only when C was moved.
Actually moved.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So what happens is that in the case of Tumas Hesse, the Adam is mesit es hatuma, meaning he causes the object that's tummy to move without even touching it. That's called tumas hesed. Now, what about the opposite scenario? What happens if the tumma?
That's for
this is general. We're not up to zav yet. Okay, so now we're talking about universal. Then we'll see.
I guess I'm confused. What happens when he causes an impure object to move? He then becomes tummy.
Correct. He becomes tummy. That's called tumas hesed. And that's a universal halacha in Tumah V'Tahara.
Even if it's indirect, okay.
Even though there was no maga. However, again, I'm still talking about universal Tumah. Mm-hmm. What happens if it works the opposite way? The Dover Tameh caused the Adam to move. Okay? Let's say somehow the Sheretz would cause a person to move. That would not be Mitamehim in universal terms. Here we have a Chumr and Zav. Are you ready for this? In Cha, in Zav, then halacha is that if the Zav is Mesit, now keep in mind, the Zav here in this context is the Dovra Tome, right? Even though he happens to be a human being, but that's irrelevant. Imagine that he was an object, right? He is the Dovra Tome, and if he is Mesit and Adam Tar, if he causes another person to move, or he causes a Kli to move, like in the example I gave you before, that's called Tumas Heset of a Zav. In other words, Tumas Heset of a Zav is a chiddush that it works in both directions. It doesn't matter if A, which is classical, the Adam HaTar is Mesit to Tumah, or the opposite, the Adam HaTameh is Mesit to Tar. That's the unique Tumas Heset of a Zav. Now, within this context, we have another chiddush. And that is that Tumas Heset of a Zav applies even to a Kli Cheres. A Kli Cheres is an earthenware utensil, which classically, again, until we get to Zav, is only Mitame Mi Avira. Okay, if I had a blackboard, I would write this on the blackboard. Avira. Now, Avira means, okay, I've got to get myself off this list here. Okay, fine. Avira means that if this is your Kli Cheres, then if the Sheretz has contact with this earthenware on the outside, it's not Metame. It's only if the Sheretz is suspended in the Avir, in the airspace of the Kli. Now the exception to that rule is Zav. That Zav could be Metame a Kli Cheres Beheset, right, Beheset, which means even if he moves the Kli, and there's nothing inside the Avir of the Kli, that is Mitami the Kli Cheres. And then again, that's a specific Chiddush by Kli Cheres. Because other Kalim, you're Mitami the Maga. So if I just substitute Hesed for Maga, then there's nothing unique about Zav except for the fact that the Dovra Tome is moving a Dovra Tar, right? Which is the opposite direction of what normally happens. But as far as a Kli Cheres is concerned, the very fact that there is such a thing as Tumas Kli Cheres without Avir, that's a Chiddush in Zav. So that's introduction number one. Now we get to introduction number two. A Zav, which is also very unique, has to count Zayin Nikiyim. And we said that the Zayin Nikiyim of a Zav applies even after Shtei Rios, if you recall. That was the discussion we had in the previous Mishnah. And within the context of Zayin Nikiyim, and this is relevant even if you learn Masechta Nida, he can be mitire himself on the seventh day. Now watch what happens. It's the morning of the seventh day. He goes into mikvah, and that tvila is I'm going to use the word conditional. I think this should be is contingent. I don't know. There should be a better word for it. On the fact that that seventh day will remain a day of tara. It's sort of like taking a gamble, if you follow what I mean. So the Torah allows him to go to mikvah on the seventh day, but yet he's still, in a sense, in a precarious situation. Why? Because if he sees another re'iyah before nightfall, that's called a re'iyah soseres. That completely undermines the Zion Nikiyim. He's going to have to start counting Zion Nikiyim again. Now here's the deal. What happens if between tefillah and re'iyah, okay, this will call time T1 is tefillah, and time T2, which is re'iyah. Re'iyah means re'iyah hasoseres. Again, this is all on the seventh day. In between, what's the opposite of contracts? He bequeaths, what's the word? He transmits. Oh, that's the word I need. Sorry. He transmits tuma. So it's a funny kind of situation because, you know, we would have said that he doesn't transmit tuma because he's already tovil, but yet that tefillah was conditional, and at the end of the day he had a re'iyah hasoseres before nightfall, so we should say l'mafreya retroactively igloi milsa. Now we've become absolutely clear that he has transmitted tuma. Yeah, that makes sense.
Thanks. Question.
Is mekanel above?
That's what we're going to discuss now about Zav. That in the case of Zav, let me just finish the sentence so I'll have a perspective here. That if the Zav has a re'iyah after Tevilah on Yom HaShvi, which is Soser, all of his Zayin Yimei Sviras Nekiyim, then it works l'mafreya. Again, this is a special chumrah of Zav. We're going to see how this applies universally to other tumas, but as far as Zav is concerned, then it comes out that all this potential transmission now actualizes itself. In other words, now it became clear that his sphere of Zayin Nikiyim was worthless because before Shkia on the seventh day he saw, and therefore there's going to be, shall I say, a clarification, if I could use that word, that the objects that he transmitted tuma to were, did in fact become tamei. So let's say, for example, again, just sorry, Eric, I'm right with you, but just give me a second. Let's say we have the case of Mishkav Hazav. You remember that we spoke about the unique chiddush of Zav, that if he sits down or lays down on one mattress, right, and there are nine other mattresses below it, all 10 mattresses contract tuma. That's called Mishkav Hazav. So if between Tevilah and Re'iyah there was Mishkav Hazav, we anticipated that there would be no transmission of Tuma. Now he has Re'iyah Soseres, and therefore all 10 mattresses are
Tuma.
See, I'm afraid to use the word retroactive here, although I think pedagogically it fits, but it could be that
it really, from the beginning they really were, but we didn't know it until
exactly. Yeah, it's more of a clarification than a lamafreya. Okay, so having said these two introductions, now we're ready for the sugya. Amalei Rava, so Rava turns to Rav Shmuel, and he says, Elameata, if you tell me that the word v'taher indicates that he already was tahar, as opposed to v'yitar in the future, and therefore we have to subtract one element of his tumah, is gavi zav, we have the same word v'taher in the parsha of Zav. The Torah says, I'm reading the whole pasuk here. You don't have the whole pasuk in front of you, but v'chiyitar azav mizovo v'sofar lo shivas yomim litaroso. Then it says v'chives pegadov v'rochatz besoro b'mayim chayim v'toher. The same word v'toher that we saw in the parasha of Mitzora, upon which Rav Shmuel in his brisa had built castles in the sky, appears in the parasha of Zav. Is Hassan my Vitar me kar ika? How are you going to interpret the word Vitar me kar, meaning in the past, that he was already tar beforehand? We don't know of any element of Tuma Vitara that was removed. Ella, says the Gemara, you know what we're going to do with the word Vitar? It's going to teach us that Tar Hashta Milatame Klicheres Beheset. In other words, after tefillah, he is going to be considered tahor, and it means that if he had a tumas hesed in which he caused the movement of a kli cheres, and we said again, there's a big chiddush here that the source of the tumah moves the object which is tar, and not only that, it's a kli cheres to boot, which is only mitame biavira, but the unique tumah of zav applies. Then what happens if he was quote unquote mitame a kli cheres behesed between tvila and re'ia on the seventh day, correct? Afal gav de hoda chazi. Hoda chazi means he saw again, meaning he had a re'iyah. He had a re'iyah of what?
Of
ziva. That would be a re'iyah soseres, correct?
Yeah.
And therefore, what we said before that with regard to zav, there was a chiddush, so to speak, of lamafreya, right? We called it lamafreya. So let's say, for example, the 10 mattresses upon which he sat between tvila and re'iyah hasoseres all become tomei. But if on the other hand he was mesed a klicheres, is lo metami lamafreya. Oh, I feel a little more comfortable. The Gemara itself uses the word lamafreya. Okay? So what does Vitaher mean? Vitaher then is telling us that even though, as far as Mishkav and Moshav is concerned, that's the 10 mattresses, if he had a re'iyah between tefillin, if he had a Mishkav between tefillah and re'iyah, everything becomes tami lamafreya. However, with regard to tumas cheres, kli cheres through hesed, if he had such a matzav between tvil and re'iyah, is we're going to say it's tar, it's hochinami. In other words, let's apply your yardstick and the interpretation of the word vitar to this situation. Oh. Just 1 second. I think I read two words that belong to the next part of the Gemara. Leave out the words hochinami. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Why is this only to this tumor? Why is it only?
I guess because again, like we said before, the name of Shakasai, we look for the biggest chiddush.
But I guess is this the only type of tumor that's only with regard to Zav?
Correct. And in two ways. It's a double entendre. On the one hand, it's a chiddush that hesek, which means that the Zav pushed, I don't mean literally push, but he caused the movement of a kli, and the kli contracts tuma. That itself is a radical chiddush, because hesed always works in the opposite direction, correct?
Right.
And number two, that there is such an institution as tumas kli cheres, which is not mi'avir, that's a double chiddush. So we're going to take that double chiddush, and we're going to say that it doesn't work l'mafreya. And why does it work l'mafreya? Because the Torah says v'tahir.
That's the only type of tumah where because I guess others are mishka and other, yeah, the tumas.
Right, maybe we find other precedents within the world of tumah v'tara, right. And it's not
like
totally
Anita
unique.
Is also there are other types of,
right, but this is mamish only like zav. You got to get to the letter Z in the alphabet until you realize that there is such an institution.
Okay.
Oh. So now the Gemara says, Hachinami. Now I want to spend a few minutes here interpreting Hachinami. Okay, there's a long Rashi on Hachinami. I'm not going to go through the Rashi, but I'm going to give you a summary of the Rashi here. He says the following, Hachinami gami mitzora muzgar, minayin lecha, this is the Rava's kash on Rabbi Shmuel, how do you know lidrosh mi v'toyer, shem mitzora muzgar eno ton prio prima? I have another option, and this will make it parallel to Zah. Efshal v'drosh mimenu, drosh adoma, l'mash adoshim v'tor l'gabi Zah, v'haynu shim toru, im tiaro ha-kohen v'toval, v'achak posha ha-nega, shu tomi l'mafreya, berov dini tumaso. Aval l'inyan ha-din shechmira Torah b'mitzor shemetami b'bi'oso l'bayis, as ha'odam that kelim shenin tsoyim sham is v'tar tells me tar hashta milatami v'bi'o l'mafreya. This is beautiful, Rabosa. Again, I don't know beans about tumah v'tara and about negoyim, but just the structure is beautiful. He says the following: What gives you the right, Reb Shmuel, to derive from Vitoher that there's no prima with regard to a Muzgar? I have another way of interpreting it. And that's based on a parallel, a mirror image of Zav. There also it says Vitoher. And what do we derive from Vitoher? That with regard to that special chiddush of Tumas Ziva, that he's Metamei Behesed, even a Kli Cheres, we're not going to say L'mafreya if he had this contact of Hesed with the Kli Cheres between what? Between Tevila and Regia. Oh, I have an exact parallel. Now again, in the case of Mitzora, we're not talking about Zayin Nikiyim, we're not talking about a Re'iyah, we're not talking about a Stira to Zayin Nikiyim. So what could we plug in this parallel for T2, if you follow me? T1 will be Mikvah, but what's T2? Oh, so this is called Pishayon. You remember there was one Simon of Tumah that was common to all the categories of Nagon. That's called Pishayon in Pasha. It means that the Kohen saw him on day number one, before the Hezger, and it was only, in fact, the Rosh has a Shita that we put a marker around the Nega, and then it expanded beyond at time T2, meaning at the end of the 7 days. So what happens in the following situation? The Kohen looks at the Nega at the end of the 7 days, and guess what? Lo Pasha Nega. It's exactly as it was a week earlier. And then the Mitzora goes to Mikvah, enters into a house. There are people in the house, other Mekalim. And then Pasha Nega. And then the Nega spreads. Now again, this Rabosai might depend on 3 out of 4 of the categories, because as we said, there might be one category which is Michon and Michya that doesn't have a second round of Hezger. But let's just assume, for argument's sake, just to make life easier for ourselves, that there's something called Pasha Nega. So the Kohen turns his back, so to speak, and immediately the Nega starts spreading. And that's equivalent to the Re'iyas Zav at the end of the 7 days, before Shkia on the 7th day, meaning that's a Soteris. Oh, so now what we're going to say is, L'mafreya, it turns out that he's Tomei B'tumas Saras, because now we have Simoni Tuma. But on the other hand, the Kohen sent him to the Mikvah, so you know he was ready in the process of purification. So what do we do here? So why don't we say the following, that Vitoher is telling me that there's a Tara Me'ikara, as far as the radical chiddush that applies uniquely to Tzaraas. So what's that radical chiddush? Ohel, right? You remember that Ohel. So what we're going to say is that with regard to Ohel, we're not going to go with Mafreya. Just like in the case of Tumas Heset of Azav on a Kli Cheres, we're not going to go with Mafreya. We're not going to say, well, now we had a Riyas Soseris, so any Kli Cheres that had that is now Tomei L'Mafreya. Why? Because the Torah says Vitoyer, to take that Kula, that minimalist Chiddush. So in the parallel case, if he sees a Re'iyah, which again, there's no Re'iyah here, but if it's Pasha Hanega between... And between Tvila and Pasha Nega, he had what? He had entered into a house, and there were people and Kalim in the house. Those Kalim will remain Tar. The person will remain Tar. Why? Because we're not going to go to Mafreya. How do you know? That's Rav's question to Rav Shmuel. To darshan from Vitoyer that a Mitzorah Muzgar is exempt from Pri and Prima. I have a different way of learning Vitoyer. And this question is so strong that Rav is now going to find a different source. He's gonna, I don't know what you want to say, he's gonna freeze, you know, he's gonna put Reb Shmuel's drasha out of commission. It's a TKO, because we need that pasuk to teach you that there's no tumas bil amafreya in a case of posha nega. So I'll read to you, he says the following, Tiro a Kohen machma shalom posha nega vitoval. So as a result of the fact that the Kohen said he's okay, he was tov rach kach shuv chazar a nega uposha bi oso ayom. On that very same day, again you have to know all the dinim here, if it's morning, afternoon, evening, and so forth and so on, but on that same day, posha nega, and now l'mafreya we understand that there is a simon tuma. So again, the Kohen was allowed to see what he saw and determine what he did, but it's all conditional, it's contingent, because we have to wait to see if the day will pass without Pasha Nega. At the end of a few hours before Shkia, Pasha Nega is Lo Yitami Adam VeKalim Shahayu Imo B'Bayis Bein Hatvila LePishon. Why? Because of the pasuk Vitayer. So who gives you the right, Reb Shmuel, to derive from the word Vitayer that there's no priya and prima with regard to a musgar? Hello, my Rava. Rava says I have to derive from a different pasuk. Mehacha. With regard to Mitzora, the Torah says V'hatzarua asheri. Oh. So here, you know, again, we're going to give this out here, if you don't mind.
But how does he have the, if this is a Brisa, and he's arguing on the Brisa, what's his...
What gives the authority to argue on a Brisa? Let me see, did Tani Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak Kami de Rav Huna?
Rav Huna didn't object,
tell me, what does he say on the Tani? I assumed it was a Brisa, but Masif doesn't say
one. It says Brisa. Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak taught a Brisa.
Taught a Brisa. That's Art Scroll adds those words, taught a Brisa. Okay.
Brisa,
he doesn't say it's a Brisa, but you're right, it has to be a Brisa. Otherwise, what's the Tani?
Right. But and it was in the presence of Rav Huna, and Rav Huna, we don't have an objection for Rav Huna,
right,
it was accepted.
Rav Huna
was
shtika kodah.
So
I don't know the answer to your question, Eric. I could just offer a couple of possibilities, but any answer I give you would be purely
a question on
purely Huma, speculation,
so,
right?
So it's
In other words, it could be that Rava has another braisa. I don't know. But the truth is that Abai is going to reject Rava's derivation too. So I'm not sure that Rava did any improvement here. but it's just. What I get excited about is the sheer brilliance of Rava's kasha. You know, it's like amazing. You know that he found an exact mirror image between Zav and Mitzora. You know, very beautiful. Anyway, he says the following: Mehocha. So here we have to open up the Chumash, and we're in Vayikra, Perek Yud Gimel. Just one second. No. Just one second. Batzuru Asher Yibo Hanega. Yep. Oh, Memhei. Okay. Asher Yibo Hanega. And this is the parsha of what? Of Prima and Priya. Yes? Oh, and it says Asher Yibo Hanoga. And what's Asher Yibo Hanoga? So Rava comes up with a brilliant possibility, an interpretation of what Asher Yibo Hanega means. Okay? Nega is the physical is the physiological phenomenon on his body. That's what the word nega means. And the Torah here, by adding these words Asher Yibo Hanoga, which are really superfluous words, is telling us what kind of a tumah are we dealing with. Meaning, what are the causes of the tumah?
And
the
what
does it say? Asher Bo Hanega, right? And what are the causes of this man's tumah? And what therefore will remove that tumah and bring him into a state of tahara? And the answer is Asher Bo Hanoga. Bo means there's a physiological phenomenon. If that physiological phenomenon passes, then he becomes tahar. Again, with all the other conditions, but we're ready for him to become tahar. That could only refer to a mukhlat. That could not refer to a muzgar. Why? Because the tum and the tara of a mukhlat are totally dependent upon the physiological phenomenon, which is called tsarato tluya begufo. And the opposite of tsarato tluya begufo, meaning the process of purification, is what's called refuas hatsaras. And that you'll see if you fast forward for one moment to Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Gimel. You'll see a pasuk that says Vehinai nirpa nirpa nega hatsaras min hatsarua. Do you see the word nega? Mm-hmm. Again, the word nega.
Right.
And it says nirpa, and that's the introduction to the process of tara. What kind of tsaras? What category of mitzora are we dealing with? Where there's nega, and then there's nirpa nega. That's only a mukhlat. Why? Now watch this chav. Yotza, to the exclusion of zeh, meaning the mitzora muzgar, she'ain tzarato tluya begufo el biyomim. Okay, watch what happens here. In the case of a muzgar, what's going to happen is that although he has the potential, in terms of the physiological phenomenon on his body, to become a tzaras, but he doesn't yet have it. Would he become tahar? Again, as we said before, with regard to all the dinim of tumah, with the exception of prima and priya, he is tamei, right at this stage. But what's going to happen now? Is he going to actually be healed? The answer is no. He's in the exact same situation at the end of the 7 days as he was at the beginning of the 7 days, or the second 7 days, whichever it was. In other words, the nega is still what's called be'en, bet ayin yud nun, which means it's the same appearance on his body. Nothing has changed, and yet he's tar. So the tara is a result of counting days. Now again, I have a strong suspicion that if we were learning this sugya the right way, there's a lot of deep, profound insight here. What that means, that the days themselves bring the tara. But what it means is the passage of time as opposed to any sort of refuah. And here in the Parsha Prima and Priya, the Torah speaks about a nega and volume nirpa nega. That is exclusively applicable to a muchlat and does not apply to a muzgar. Alright, Rabbos, I think we'll stop here. And we were almost at the finish line for this Mishnah. It'll take us, I think, about 10-15 minutes to get to the finish line, Mitzvah Shem. So tomorrow, hopefully, we'll start the Mishnah of Svarim. Let's make a note of where we got up to. Amar Le Abaye. Abaye is also going to ask Akasha on Rava, that if Rava's style or method of drasha is consistent, we're going to come to some untenable positions about Shiluach Min HaMachne. And therefore, Rava's going to have to backtrack a little and come up with a different sort of a drasha. And then finally, the last few lines of this Gemara is going to be about Tiglachas and Tzipora. Okay then? So everyone should have a great day. Good.